Spectator magazine is the greatest magazine in the English language. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online to see for yourselves. Also, against my advice as editor, we're giving away a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Given that you're spending 12 quid, you can do the maths. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher. But don't hurry, because this offer probably loses us money.
Hello and welcome to Chinese Whispers with me, Cindy Yu. Every episode, I'll be talking to journalists, experts and longtime China watchers about the latest in Chinese politics, society and more. There'll be a smattering of history to catch you up on the background knowledge and some context as well. How do the Chinese see these issues? When I recently came across a book review asking the question, was Marco Polo a sexpat? I knew I had to get its author on to, well, discuss this important question some more. The 13th century Venetian merchant Marco Polo's account of China was one of the earliest and most popular travelogues written on the country. And he spent years at the court of Kublai Khan, the grandson of Genghis, who ruled over China in the Yuan dynasty. My guest today and the author of that book review is the historian Jeremiah Jenny. Jeremiah has lived in China for over two decades, and he is also the co-host of the fascinating podcast Barbarians at the Gate, all about Chinese history. He has been doing a series of historical book reviews for the relatively newly established website China Books Reviews. And in rereading the travels of Marco Polo, he noticed that there was a lot of sex. We talk about all this, of course, but there's a serious point here too. How much do Europeans observe when they go to China? And how reliable are their accounts, understood and told through the perspective of outsiders? How much has Marco Polo's portrayal of China moulded the Western mindset on the country in the centuries since, and even today? And what does it say about China in the 13th century that a few Venetian merchants like Marco Polo and his family could have found their way to the heart of the empire? So, here's my conversation with Jeremiah Jenny. Jeremiah Jenny, welcome to Chinese Whispers.
Thank you.
It's great to have you on the show. I'm a big fan of your podcast. To start with, I thought maybe you could give us an overview of who Marco Polo was and what he claimed to do in his life for anyone who doesn't know.
Well, Marco Polo is probably one of the most famous, we'll just say Europeans, to travel to China. He makes that voyage in the late 13th century as part of a return journey being undertaken by his father and uncle, who were merchants who plied the routes between Europe and East Asia. Ultimately, the father and uncle had ended up in the court of Kublai Khan, who was the ruler of the Mongolian Empire, what in China parts of it were called the Yuan Dynasty. And when they came back to the Khan's court on a return mission, they brought with them the teenaged Marco Polo, who then spent quite a few years then afterwards in China. He returns back to Europe, back to Venice, and for a while, nobody believed the things he saw. He was not the first expat to come back from a extended period in China, and every conversation begins with, yeah, actually, but this one time when I was in China, people got pretty tired of that. Although it did get picked up by some, Marco Polo spent a little time in prison on the wrong side of one of the many wars over the Italian peninsula and the control of the Mediterranean. And when he's in prison, or it's kind of like a, country club prison, but one of the people he meets is a writer named Rustichello da Pisa, who was famous as being kind of a hack writer for king, writing accounts of like King Arthur and other kind of like stories and, tales. And apparently the two of them collaborated on a travelogue, a book about Marco Polo's journeys. And that's the book that has come down to us through the ages. And that's the reason we're so familiar with his name.
And this all happens in about the 1200s or so. What was China like at that time that a trio of Venetian merchants can make it into the court of the emperor, who is Kublai Khan being the grandson of Genghis Khan?
Right. So, I mean, in the late 13th century, you have, Kublai Khan is consolidating his control over the eastern part of the, Mongolian world. And of course, the Mongolians under Genghis Khan and his descendants, they conquer almost everything between Korea and Europe. And for a time there, we think about the Mongolian conquest as being, crazy, bloody, drinking like wine out of the skulls of our enemies kind of thing. And sure, that happens. It's part of the fun thing about being a Mongolian ruler. But once you finish that conquest, what you also have are, for the first time, from Korea to Western Europe, almost this entire like vast sea of grass, this vast steppe, and all the roots in between are all under more or less the same empire or parts of the same empire. So instead of having to negotiate with every single kingdom, principality, duchy, city, state, what have you, getting into trouble all the way for almost the first time in a long time, you could travel across the known world. And some historians have even called it Pax Mongolica. So the Polos are not the only non-Mongols, non-Chinese who are coming to the capital. Kublai Khan's rebuilding as new capital just inside of China, you know, it's where it's modern day Beijing is located, although back then they referred to it as the city of the Khans, Kambalak, or in Chinese, Dadu, the great capital. If you were there, I don't know if it was quite as cosmopolitan as like Tang Dynasty Chang'an, which was, you know, one of the most famous global cities of all time, but certainly you would see many people from all over Asia, even Europe and other parts of, you know, in the streets, at court, even doing administrative functions for the Khan. So the Polos are not this kind of oddity. I mean, they're interesting, but they're not the only ones hanging around town.
I always kind of had this vague sense that it's because they were one of the only Europeans that they were seen as something of a novelty, then they, therefore they accessed that higher echelon. But you're saying that actually not so out of the ordinary.
You know, Europeans weren't the most common group to be in the city of the Khans, but there were other ones there. According to Polo's own account, it had a little bit to do with his own kind of personal charm, charisma. Here's this, you know, relatively young man, you know, who picks up all these languages. And again, it's one of the, in some ways, I keep coming back to this, you know, Marco Polo sets the template for almost every like expat memoir of a Lao Wai coming to China. And one of the aspects of that template is to greatly exaggerate maybe just how close and in demand he was, or how his connections with the people in power, like, so, you know, it makes it sound like he was in the service of the Khan, and maybe he was, but things like, was he the governor of a city, or, you know, was he a member of the bodyguard, or these kind of things, it's harder to kind of know if that's really true or not.
Now, Jeremiah, you recently wrote a book review provocatively headlined Marco Polo, Travel Writer, Fraud, Sexpat. What did he do to deserve that last label?
Well, it's part of a series that I'm writing for the China Books Review, which is a great new website. And the series itself is I'm writing is kind of looking back at some of the great books about China that have been published over the ages. And, you know, why are these books so important? What's the legacy of them? Where do they come from? And of course, you know, Marco Polo seems like a really good place to start. And it is. But one of the things about Marco Polo, too, is a lot of people, they know the name, but no one's really actually, you know, often read the book. And so there's a couple of things about that I wanted to talk about. You know, the idea of he didn't start out to write like a travel diary. It's not like day 34 on the outskirts of the empire. It's almost like a version of Lonely Planet or Fodor's Guide for Merchants in, or, you know, travelers to this part of the world. So it has more of a guidebook kind of aspect to it. And so in that way, I kind of wanted people to realize that it's not quite like the expat memoir. It's more like rough guide to the Khan's empire. The fraud aspect of it, there's been a lot of talk over the years, and there's even a very famous work by a historian, a great historian, by the way, named Francis Wood, that kind of questioned whether or not Marco Polo ever made it. And so I wanted to kind of touch on that too. I honestly came down on the side of he probably did, but not everything that's in his book happened, or if it did, or some of its descriptions, just like guidebook writers often do, may have come from other sources. So it may also be a pastiche. And of course, this is all being done. He's dictating this to another person who's embellishing it and writing it down by hand. And then that copy gets copied. That copy gets copied. So, you know, some of the inaccuracies, some of the discrepancies, some of the gaps, that makes sense if we think about how this actual text was produced, how it was disseminated. The sexpat thing, I guess maybe I hadn't read Marco Polo in a while either. I was just kind of amazed at how just fascinated he is with who's having sex, who they're having sex with, why aren't they having it with him? I mean, one of the things about a book when it's written as a guidebook, we don't get a lot of information about his inner life. This is a man who grew up from his late teens until his 30s. His entire development as an adult takes place as someone from Europe living in, you know, a faraway land, right? So we don't know what his intimate life was like. Did he have partners? We don't know any of that stuff. But he is, I mean, one of the things about his book, and this is, again, part of the template, I think, for later writers, not just in China, but European writers around the world. We look back in the days of imperialism, colonialism, and one of the things that European writers always talked about was, wow, we came to this place, and let me tell you how freaky these people can get. And Marco Polo has that there, too. I mean, he writes down about villages or lands he travels to, and the women seem to be throwing themselves at him, and all they expect in return is a couple of trinkets. And he seems to think this is some, like, brand new business model. Like, he's never actually seen the idea of, like, somebody will have sex in exchange for something valuable. He thinks he's invented fire here. But he does talk a lot about that. He talks about how in Kambalak there was something like 20,000 women ready to sleep with men for money. And he's really impressed by that large number. And so it's not the only thing he writes about. Don't get me wrong. I was a little bit surprised rereading this and honestly probably rereading it for the first time myself in like 25 years. Wow, he's talking about this an awful lot. I wanted to kind of just include that so people kind of realize that that's part of the kind of expat memoir, expat travelogue, expat travel book template that actually also goes back to the days of Marco Polo.
A pioneer. But Gemma, what's interesting is that the way he sees these women isn't necessarily that they're prostitutes, but it's more that I think he says that they're almost kind of practicing for future husbands. He tries to kind of intellectualize it in a cultural sense. Can you talk about that a bit? Because he doesn't see it as prostitution.
No, and not every particular case he describes is it a situation where it are, for example, women who are having sex with travelers in exchange for some kind of gift or other exchange at the end of their stay. He's also recording places where there seems to be customs of, you know, it reminds me a little bit of some of the latter day internal writings in China about the Han Chinese writing about like going to places like Yunnan, for example, and encountering customs like in the Mosuo, things like walking marriage, and then kind of somewhat misinterpreting what's happening here and also kind of sensualizing a little bit. And that idea, you know, that we think of that as being part of, you know, later on Orientalism, or in the case of China, internal Orientalism. And it is interesting, you know, Polo's writing in a much earlier era. He's writing before kind of the age of colonialism, although in some ways his book kind of inspires part of that. But it is also interesting that some of those tropes that we associate with that kind of Orientalism, the feminization, the fetishization, the kind of maybe not excessive, but certainly, let's just say, interest in the sexual practices and how that makes the other different from me because they do this in the bedroom and we do not. And this is interesting to me. That kind of thing that we see is very much part of that Orientalist discourse later. It is interesting how those tropes seem to appear in a little bit of Marco Polo's own, you know, experience or his own way that he recounts his time in this part of the world.
And obviously listeners will know the word expat, but I'm not sure everyone would have heard the term sexpat before. And Jeremiah, you've been in China for over 2 decades, I think it is. Is that still very much a phenomenon, that kind of European or Westerner in general going to Asia, kind of seeking a kind of allure of the Eastern woman and kind of thing? Is that still very much a trope, in a sense, that it's worthy of a term?
I think that in the 21st century, we're a lot more aware of these tropes and also a lot more aware of how people are objectified when we write, when we talk. You know, I think that's something that's good. Is this something that still has a long way to go? Absolutely. I also think that in China, while you certainly see some of that in writings about China, I feel like it's a much bigger problem in other parts of Asia, particularly those where there are even greater economic disparities. And as a result, you have forms of economic coercion that do exist in China, but probably not in quite the same way as they do in some other parts of this region. I will say that as much as it has been a problem for Westerners, I think, as I was alluding to before, there's been quite a boisterous and problematic domestic sexpat tourism, of course. You know, a lot of it focused on places like Yunnan. You have, you know, men from especially Han Chinese men from like the urban areas, you know, Beijing, Shanghai, going to places like Yunnan and kind of thinking that the women there, because they are of these other groups who have different practices, that they must be more free. And with the exact same kind of tropes that we saw that Westerners writing about Asia, Westerners writing about other parts of the world, it just seems to be, you know, it seems to track very closely. So I think those things still exist. I don't think they're necessarily as much of a problem as they were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. But I'll tell you, I mean, they are still a problem, and it is a process by which I think we need to be far more aware of just what this means and why these attitudes and these ideas continue to persist and the damage that can cause.
Okay, so well, going back to Marco Polo then, Jeremiah, you mentioned Frances Wood. What's her argument for Marco Polo not even having made it to China?
It's an interesting book to read because, you know, she looks at the things that Marco Polo doesn't talk about. You know, where's the foot binding? Where's the Great Wall? You know, where are these things? She makes an argument, and it's certainly a very strong one, that there are discrepancies. There are things, you know, there are, where, if he's such an integral part of the Khan's court, where are the sources in Chinese that mention this remarkable person, you know, who apparently was essential to the running of the empire or something like that, right? And they're not there. So what's going on with that? And I think those are, you know, all very valid critiques. I think other scholars have also pointed out that some of the things that, first of all, looking at somebody for what they don't mention is a little bit trickier than trying to kind of look at what they do mention and see how that lines up with what other sources say. Mm. The Great Wall, for example, we think of the Great Wall, you know, we see the pictures outside of Beijing of this like amazing structure with the bricks and the towers. That's really a product of a dynasty that occurs after the Mongolians. The Mongolians, who have now conquered China and the steppe, for them, they, you know, there were aspects of what we think of as the Great Wall that were still fortified, but it wasn't the thing that it would become later. So, I mean, that's just one example. But I also think, too, that there is a lot about Marco Polo's story that is plausible. Is it enough to prove definitively, did he show up? No. But is there enough there that we could speculate that it is more likely to be true than not? Yeah, I think that's probably the case. And, you know, part of that, too, is he's not the only person making this trip in each direction. We have, for example, sources in other languages of people who have traveled from Persia, from West Asia, who made that trip as well. We have Chinese travelers, Mongolian travelers who are going the other direction. There are some, you know, corroborate. This is not an improbable journey. This was something, this was a pretty, you know, it was a difficult trip. Going overland across Asia, and then they take the ocean going back. I mean, this was not an easy jaunt, to be sure, but this wasn't like breaking trails into the great unknown. They were following very, very well-developed routes. We say Silk Road, but of course it's not a road, and this term wouldn't even be used until the 19th century. But these kind of point-by-point, market-to-market, like across Asia, they're well-defined trade routes. That they're following all the way from Europe, getting all the way to what's today Beijing.
Is there anything in particular in Marco Polo's account that stands out to you as, yes, he would only know about this if he had actually got somewhere close or at least made it? Is there anything in particular that just stands out to you?
Well, I think some of his descriptions of the city, Kambalak, he actually, there are other better descriptions of Beijing at the time, but he has some pretty good descriptions of the Khan's court. You know, some of his descriptions of some of the other parts of China that he travels to, theoretically on missions for the Khan. And by the way, this wouldn't have necessarily, I mean, he may exaggerate how close he is with the Khan, but we do know that Kublai Khan often trusted outsiders or non-Chinese, non-Mongols on very important missions, in part because, like a lot of other kings, sometimes an outsider who, for example, owes their loyalty to you is more trustworthy than maybe one of your own staff who maybe have a lot of connections. So not outside the realm of possibility, he would have been sent on some kind of mission. And some of his descriptions of these places, they still match, you know, some of these places even today. So for that, for those reasons, you kind of look at it and go, well, as any historian can, you can't know 100%, right? But you have to kind of look and go, well, it seems more likely than not. But we also have to allow, as I said again, for embellishments, cribbing from other sources and all of that too. You can't just take it as like, this is exactly what happened. But I think it's tough. You can't just dismiss it completely out of hand.
And I wonder if we can talk about the influence of Marco Polo in the generations since, because you mentioned in your book review that, for example, when McCartney was going to for his audience with the Emperor Qianlong in 1793, he read Marco Polo. So just how influential was this piece of work for the Europeans who came after him?
You could make an argument that this is probably one of the most influential books ever written in a European language, not even about China, but just in general. You think about what the book inspired. Once it started circulating widely in Europe, it became quite popular. And there were many different versions. Not all the versions are the same, many different versions circulating. Columbus had a copy of it. For example, and it was a huge inspiration for him. It was something that even as late as the 18th century, as you mentioned, when Lord McCartney makes his takes his trade delegation to Beijing to encourage China's rulers to stop manipulating their currency and open their markets and make it easier for foreign investment and all the stuff that they still argue with him. But he had a copy of it as well. And the idea that this book inspired a lot of Europeans to think there is something out there, this great land that we need to reach. And once the Mongolian Empire collapses, which happens less than 60 years or so after Marco Polo returns to Europe, those routes across Asia suddenly become far more complicated. And so what's left? Go by ocean. Well, those ocean routes are also pretty complicated too, at least the most famous ones. And so then people start thinking, like, what's another way to get there? And of course, we know what that inspired as well. So there's a really kind of an argument to be made just about just how important this book was to, again, not just the history of European relations with China, but European relations with the whole world.
Well, when it comes to the European view of China, then for the generations afterwards, is there a cautionary tale in Marco Polo's work in the sense that, yes, it's one of the first pieces of work of this kind, but as we've talked about, there are presumably embellishments and things that just don't quite seem rigorous, let's put it that way. So are there cautionary tales for people who write about China from a European perspective who come after?
Books that are written today are written in such a different way than they would have been written in Marco Polo's time. Remember, Marco Polo is kind of dictating he's sitting there. I mean, we don't know how this actually played out, but we kind of vision him sitting there, like telling his pretty well-rehearsed stories, probably that he's probably told many times to this writer who's writing it down, and also kind of trying to make it sing a little bit, trying to make it like this writer, he sells books, he wants to make it a good story. So there's that. But there is this idea that with the embellishments, sometimes it's very easy to kind of take a look and see the first observation being our observation, but never asking the question of like why this is. And I think one of the challenges for this is, and it still happens today, although I hope it happens less, there is still the challenge of othering China in our writing, whether it's through journalism, academia, popular books, what have you. And when we write about the other in a way that creates that kind of that difference, right? Like, oh, well, we do this and they do that. And then not following it up with the next question, why? Why is what I am seeing different or counter to my expectations or my own cultural background? But simply just accepting like, okay, well, that's another example of how these people are different. And that's problematic, right? Of course, we want to know what we share as humans, not necessarily just make a list of all the ways that we are different. And I think, some of Marco Polo's observations, at least as they're recorded, tend to be a little bit of the, so I showed up in town and these people were weird and then we moved on. And I'm paraphrasing here a little bit, but yeah, I mean, that's kind of, and I'll be honest, there's not a few travel books in the late 20th, early 21st century or writings about China in the West in the 21st century that are sort of like, we showed up and these people are weird. And the old cliche that, stories about China are either big China, bad China, or weird China. Well, Marco Polo, at a time when at least the Mongolian Empire was a much more developed civilization than what Marco Polo is leaving, he didn't really have bad China, but he did definitely, talk a lot about big China and weird China.
Jeremiah, that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for joining Chinese Whispers.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Chinese Whispers. I hope you enjoyed it. If you're listening to this podcast on the Best of the Spectator channel, remember that Chinese Whispers has its own channel as well. If you just search Chinese Whispers wherever you get your podcast from, you will always get the latest episode first there. If you have any feedback, positive or negative, but preferably constructive, please do email me at podcast@spectator.co.uk. And I'd also love it if you left a review or told your family and friends about the podcast. It's the way to help us grow. So thanks so much for listening, and join us again next time.